Good afternoon, and welcome to the Ninth Circuit. Before we begin, Judge Paez and myself would like to thank once again Judge Katsubai from Oregon for visiting with us. It's been a very helpful, and as always.
It's been a privilege. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. I know, is there going to be a split on the petitioner side?
So, Your Honor, I'm for leaky and plan to use the whole time to discuss the rule. If the court does have questions about the individual assignment plans, this is exactly.
Okay. Okay. Got it. That makes sense. Okay, counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Morgan Russell from the ACLU on behalf of amici and supportive petitioners. I'll aim to save 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll watch the clock. Before I jump into why the rule is inconsistent with the statute, I did just want to preface that discussion by reiterating that amici's position is that the court does not need to reach the legality of the rule in order to grant this petition, and we don't think this case is the best vehicle for deciding on the legality of the rule. As we noted in our brief, both the East Bay case that's currently pending and ripe for decision back before the district court on remand from this court, and the MA case that's ripe for decision in DC present additional claims against the rule apart from the statutory issue that this court asked for briefing on. And that includes claims that turn on the administrative record for the rule, which is not before the court in this petition.
Interesting. So what is happening with the East Bay case? It's in the district court after the remand.
It's in the district court following the remand. Judge Tiger ordered supplemental briefing last summer once the case was remanded, and those were filed last summer. It's been pending with back in the Northern District of California since then, and in the D.C. case, so you know, there was renewed summary judgment briefing following an abeyance in
so
that
let
case.
Me ask you this. So why would it be – why do those cases present a better vehicle?
Our position is just that they present a more comprehensive vehicle to get at all the aspects of the rule in addition to the statutory question. For example, in the transit ban decision, East Bay 2, before this court, that rule was the majority held the rule to be in conflict with the statute and also arbitrary and capricious based on the record in that case. Another member of the panel, Judge Miller, disagreed on the statutory question, agreed it was arbitrary and capricious based on the record. So our position is just that, you know, there's a likelihood that one side or the other would seek further review whenever the legality of this rule is decided. And our position is that, you know, at least, you know, as our interests go, it would be important for there to be a comprehensive vehicle that includes all those issues whenever that further review happens of the rule.
So what additional issues are they? I'd also ask it from the other side. What makes the other cases, particularly the D.C. case, a better vehicle?
Well, both of those cases present, for example, an argument similar to the argument from the prior transit ban decision from this court that the administrative record for the rule showed that asylum is not actually available in transit countries. And so the rule was arbitrary and capricious because it reached a conclusion contrary to the administrative record in asserting that asylum was meaningfully available in those places. That's an argument, for example, that turns on facts about those transit countries in the administrative record. And so, you know, we think it would be important for a case in which the legality of the rule is going to be decided and could go up for further review to include that aspect as well as the pure statutory question.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that our prior cases in East Bay 1 and East Bay 2 foreclose the rule?
I do. Yes. Yes, Your Honor. We do think the rule is inconsistent with the statute under those decisions.
So then it ought to be a fairly straightforward decision, and yet you would still ask this court not to consider whether the CLP is invalid because of some other cases that might make their way through. I would note that I think one of the cases was stayed for quite a long time, and for which a decision I think hasn't been made. So at some point, everything will be held up if a decision isn't approached.
Right, Your Honor. So the East Bay case was, there was a stay pending appeal issued by this court. Judge Paez was on the panel. Then subsequently, there was an abeyance. It came out of abeyance. The case was argued, and it was remanded back to the district court. You know, as I said, the supplemental briefing on remand has occurred. That case is ripe for decision. I realize that the court will do what it thinks it needs to do in deciding this petition. I just wanted to state our position while I have the opportunity.
And so how would you rule if you to avoid the dealing with the rule?
So I think two possibilities, Your Honor. One would be assuming that the court is inclined to reverse on the denial of asylum. We think it would make sense to reverse on the denial of withholding as well, which was based on those same issues, past persecution and nexus, which are the same, the nexus standard being even easier, a lower bar than the asylum nexus standard. And if the court does that, we think it would make sense to also instruct the agency on remand to consider in the first instance whether the petitioners qualify for the family unity exception to the rule, which this family would appear to potentially qualify for if either of the parents, either of the adult petitioners, is ultimately found eligible for withholding. So that's one possibility which we sketched out in the amicus in footnote 2. You know, another possibility could be to hold this petition until the East Bay case comes back to the court on remand, if the court were so inclined. With all that said, if the court does reach the legality of the rule in deciding this petition, the court certainly should hold the rule unlawful. In the two East Bay cases, this court has already held that the government cannot force people to come to ports of entry or to have sought protection in a transit country in order to maintain their eligibility for asylum here in the United States.
So you mentioned earlier that we stayed that the first East Bay pending appeal. What are we going to make of that? Does that suggest that our precedent doesn't govern any of this, and that all that means, you know, that likelihood of success of the merit is weaker in this case because of the changes in the rule?
So, you know, that's the order granting a stay pending appeal did not provide reasons. I think even if it had, and even if this was the merits of that same East Bay case, that wouldn't be binding on this panel for the reasons explained in the panel opinion in the East Bay entry ban case, which kind of addressed that issue, sort of the effect of a stay opinion. The stay order in the East Bay case was, you know, as I said, didn't provide its reasoning, so I don't think there's much that
can be
drawn from
that. Well, can we presume from the stay, though, that panel at least thought that the two prior precedents of the entry rule and the transit rule were not governing?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I mean, I think, you know, one distinction is that at the time that this rule, the circumvention of lawful pathways rule, was sort of in effect at the border as the government's kind of first line, you know, effort to, in its words, manage the border. That's not the case now. This rule stopped applying to people who crossed the border on May 11th, 2025. So it's no longer sort of serving that whatever front end.
How many people were affected by the rule? Do you know?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't know if the government knows. I think thousands, tens of thousands of people came in within that 2-year period at least. So, you know, everyone who came in during that period has their cases pending in immigration court. They're still subject to the rule. We certainly are, you know, working to try to get the rule vacated through the other cases, and there is urgency in that respect.
Two related questions, if you don't mind. Do you know, because this rule only applies to non-Mexicans, do you know in that period how many non-Mexicans would have crossed, or?
I don't have that number, Your Honor.
And then, because the rule is over, and I don't know if the government's trying to reinstate it, is there a mootness problem?
Well, I don't think there's a mootness problem, certainly. So the way it works, just to be clear, is anyone who came in, and this is in the regulation specifically at 1208.33, the last subsection makes clear that anyone who came in during that period, May 11, 2023 to May 11, 2025, you know, who's in that category of non-Mexicans, adults and family to whom the rule applies, the rule continues to apply to them in their proceedings going forward, whenever those ultimate immigration court proceedings are.
Right.
So there's sort of a whole cohort of thousands of people who entered during that period to whom the rule still applies.
And maybe another reason why we wouldn't rule, because it would only apply to this petitioner, whereas in the other East Bay case, it would probably be more injunctive relief. Would that be true? Or
right. We're seeking, in both of those district court cases, the remedy we've sought is vacatur. That's the remedy that the district court...
And here the remedy would only just be for the one petitioner? Or could you seek vacatur in this...
Well, I don't think we can get vacatur. I think if this court were to hold in this petition or another petition for review that the rule is unlawful, then I think that decision would be binding on immigration courts within the Ninth Circuit. Mm. But it wouldn't vacate the rule as such, and it wouldn't affect...
So for all of the individuals, that non-citizens that are subject to the CLP between that two-year time period, are... in the absence of any decision about whether the CLP is valid or not, are they still subject to the ongoing procedures for removal under the immigration laws? Meaning, I mean, while we're waiting for the best case, as you might be asking this court to consider, are people also still being potentially subject to the application of the CLP?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And so they could be removed while we're waiting for a decision to be made.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I also understand East Bay 1 and 2 address a different rule, not the CLP. And I think that's one of the arguments that the CLP is sort of a different variation of the same species, or at least maybe one of the arguments about the difference between the two. So East Bay 1 and 2 don't do anything with respect to how CLP is being applied now until we address CLP.
Right, so because it's different rules, different agency actions, those decisions haven't, you know, they haven't kind of vacated this rule. This rule is still in effect. We do think that those decisions essentially control the statutory question, because in those two cases, this court held that, you know, the government, as I was saying, can't force people to come to ports of entry, can't force people to have sought protection in transit countries. This rule reimposes those same two requirements as its supposed lawful pathways for people to come to the country and preserve their asylum eligibility. But the government can't force people to choose between illegal requirements that it couldn't impose standing alone. And so we think...
But here they combine the two, right? The transit rule and entry rule.
Right.
And then add on like an exceptional circumstance.
Yeah, there's an emergency, a narrow emergency exception. But that emergency exception, we also think, doesn't distinguish or save this rule. I see that's my... I have 3 minutes
we'll
left.
We'll give you... I mean, there... Yeah, please finish.
Sure. We don't think that emergency exception can distinguish or save this rule either, because in the same way, the government can't require someone to show extraordinary circumstances to get an exception from a requirement that the government couldn't impose in the first place. And we think the Supreme Court's decision in Gall v. United States is instructive on that point. I think there's also a second reason. I think there's a second reason, aside from this sort of problem of imposing two requirements that they couldn't impose in the first place and making people choose between them, we have a second reason the rule is unlawful that we think is equally straightforward, which is that now it's clear from the government's own data that really the only option was for people to come to the port of entry, and the so-called transit denial pathway is really just a very narrow exception to that clearly dominant kind of entry-based method of operation of the rule. So the vast majority of people who were able to overcome the bar, it's because they came to the port of entry with a CBP-1 exception. The government's data shows that both under the prior transit ban that this court held unlawful and under this rule, only a tiny percentage of people have ever been able to satisfy that. It was 2% of people for nearly the whole year that the prior transit ban was in effect. The government's declarations in the district court cases about this rule show that it was similarly tiny percentage, some share of 3 or 4%. So we think in practice this rule operates as just another entry ban that conflicts with the first sentence of the asylum statute that makes asylum available whether or not at a designated port of arrival.
Let me, if I may.
Yeah, please. Why don't we just finish the questions and we'll give you as much time for rebuttal.
Let me just ask you a few questions about looking at the rule in the context of this case. The petitioner has a claim for asylum, withholding, and CAT.
Yes, sir.
Not mistaken. So, is it okay, or is it proper, or to think about the asylum request for asylum? To think, well, under the rule, there's a presumption that the petitioner is not eligible for asylum, right? Is that the way it works?
Right. The presumption is the terminology of the rule. I think in practice, it's just really
the rule.
Operates as a bar with exceptions. But
okay. So until he can get over that, until the petitioner can overcome that bar, he's not eligible for asylum. Is that right?
Right.
He can overcome it by the exceptions or by showing that the presumption is rebutted.
Right. Or as we pointed out, one exception that only applies in removal proceedings is the family unity exception, where if the bar would apply, but at least one of the family members can qualify for withholding, and that's, the only way for, because withholding doesn't have derivative beneficiaries, if the only way for the family to all get to stay is through asylum, then that can kind of kick in as another way for the family to overcome.
Maybe this
the
is
bar.
A question for counsel for petitioner, but in this case, was the family bar raised at all?
The exception?
The exception, what? I'm sorry.
I'm not sure on the record if it was raised. I do know that it wouldn't have applied in the under the immigration judge's decision below, because the immigration judge denied withholding to the whole family, and the family unity exception is only available if at least one of the lead petitioners, one of the parents who can have the kids as a beneficiary, would qualify for withholding. So that's why it wouldn't have been available below under the agency's basis for decision. But if this court reverses as to withholding and as to asylum, it could be available. And so that's why we think it could make sense for the agency to address that in the first instance if this court does reverse as to both withholding and asylum.
Okay, so the BIA denied the petition primarily on the basis of no past persecution. What happened was didn't rise to the level of persecution, and there was no nexus.
Right.
If we were to conclude that both those determinations were supported by substantial evidence, then I guess there would be no reason to reach.
Right. Then the court also wouldn't reach the legality of the rule. I think that's the government's reason why the court doesn't need to reach it.
We do have discretion, though, whether or not to reach it. Correct.
Right. As I said, I just wanted to make our position clear. I understand that the court can decide how it wants to. How it wants to handle the case if it does decide to reverse on asylum.
The prior rules, the entry rule and transit rule, do they have this rebuttable presumption, or was it? I thought it was just a flat-out bar, right?
Right. I mean, it's phrased as a bar, maybe more clearly in those rules. I would note that in the prior transit-based rule, there was an exception. There was a narrow exception there for trafficking victims. So it's not the case that there were no exceptions in those prior rules. I don't think the framing as a rebuttable presumption is particularly meaningful. I mean, one thing is that rebuttable presumption language is only the rules terminology for the emergency exception. The other kind of the transit denial exception, or the supposed exception for parole programs, those, as I understand it, are just kind of phrased as exceptions or ways to overcome the bar, whereas it's the emergency exception that's phrased as a rebuttal ground.
Just the emergency exception that can be rebutted? It's not the whole ineligibility?
I believe that's the part of the regulation that's phrased specifically as a rebuttal ground.
All of these questions turn on sort of the first step of determining asylum, which is eligibility to even apply, as opposed to the merits decision?
Well, eligibility, I think eligibility on the merits, yeah, right. It's a bar that would deny people eligibility regardless of the merits of their individual case. Obviously, you know, as in this case, the agency could kind of rule in the alternative. That's what happened here. They said on the merits, we're denying based on past persecution and nexus, and then we're also saying in the alternative they would be barred by the rule.
Sure, I'm just sort of rolling back to the original question that we were discussing, which is the difference between whether CLP is supportable under the statute or not. And it seems like all of this really need, in the context of the government's or the Attorney General's discretion, it's much more limited with respect to step one, eligibility to apply for asylum, where there's maybe a different set of rules for discretion or determination of getting asylum or having asylum denied.
Yes.
And I want to make sure that there's a very, I think, pretty clear limit as to what the Attorney General is allowed to do as it relates to whether non-citizens can apply in the first instance.
Yeah, I think I understand the question now, Your Honor. My apologies. So, yes, we think, you know, the government argues here their primary defense of the rule is that they can draw on their ultimate discretion to deny asylum even to eligible non-citizens to give them some more leeway or power in adopting eligibility rules like this one. And I think that this court's precedent squarely forecloses that argument as well.
The government. Well, I mean, 1158 is pretty clear about placing modifications or limits to eligibility only so long as it is consistent with the INA.
Mm-mm.
I mean, and so it is a limit of authority. I think it's been understood to be, based on a precedent, that it is a limit on the Attorney General's authority to determine eligibility to apply for asylum in that first step analysis.
Yes, Your Honor. So this court held, and specifically in the transit ban case, rejected exactly the kind of discretionary argument the government makes here, quoted the government's brief saying almost word for word what it says here, that asylum is always a matter of executive discretion, never of entitlement, said that's different from the power to adopt regulatory eligibility bars because that power to adopt regulatory bars is constrained by Congress's requirement in Section 1158b2c that such regulations be consistent with the entirety of the asylum statute. And the court said that kind of allowing the government to use its ultimate discretion to give it additional leeway in adopting those bars would make that consistency requirement in Section B2C superfluous.
So what I always find fascinating, though, I mean, I think you would concede, though, that the government can use the fact of entry, illegal entry outside the port in the individual case, right, as a discretionary factor in denying asylum, but if they put it in paper beforehand, then that's inconsistent. I've never understood that argument.
So I think, you know, what the board and this court have long held is that manner of entry can be one factor at that ultimate discretionary stage. But even then, the board has said it can't be dispositive. This court has cautioned that it is worth little weight. And so it has to be kind of at most one factor in that holistic totality of the circumstances determination at the discretionary stage. And I think this court has properly distinguished that kind of holistic analysis at the discretionary stage from a bar at the eligibility stage.
Well, wouldn't one argument be that this rule does consider other factors as well, as like if you met, you know, any of these other emergency, medical emergencies, all the other exceptions that they talk about? So it is not just the factor of entry at the port, it's other factors as well.
Well, I really think this is worlds away from the kind of holistic totality of the circumstances analysis that Matter of Pula requires and that this court has upheld and supported. I mean, in reality, people needed to come to a port of entry unless they could show one of a couple of exceptions. the parole exception actually was not available to the people who were subject to the rule, so that's a quote-unquote exception for people who aren't subject to the rule in the first place, so I don't think that gets the government anywhere. The transit denial exception is kind of, one other possibility, but that's only ever been satisfied by a tiny percentage of people, and those kind of very tiny exceptions, I think this court didn't find relevant in the transit ban case. It had a small exception like that. The Supreme Court has not found it, those kind of tiny exceptions, to matter in cases like the National Federation of Independent Businesses case that we cited about the OSHA COVID vaccine mandate. And that leaves the emergency exception. So really it's this port of entry requirement, one tiny exception for transit, this emergency exception that is an exception to this port of entry requirement that the government can't impose in the first place. So I do think it's quite a different setup that is, we think, squarely controlled by the court's prior decisions.
Let's see. Is there any other questions? Maybe we should hear from the government now.
Could I put a bookmark
on
something? I mean, you started with a fairly provocative suggestion, which is we shouldn't address the CLP here. And I have to say that I'm not sure I either understand or I'm convinced by your explanation so far. It's been a bit too vague. You don't need to answer it now, but when you come back on your additional time, I'd like for you to hit me over the head with a clear explanation as to why you don't think we should be touching the rule in this case because other cases are better postured. Now again, you don't need to answer it now, but I'm going to give you an opportunity.
Can I take one quick stab at it now, Your Honor? Well, I think our interest is in getting this rule vacated and keeping it vacated. And we think the best way to ensure doing that, like if we could decide the cases the way we wanted to decide them, we think the best way to ensure doing that in a way that produces the most kind of the strongest decision with the best chance of surviving any subsequent review would be in one of those other cases.
So I do understand that's the interest that you've described, but I need you to be granular with me. I don't understand at this stage why you think it isn't the best way or why you think another case is the best way. Eliminate the qualitative adjective. I want you to tell me specifically what is at stake, what decisions would expose this case to something that you wouldn't like as opposed to those other cases. Specifically, but I want to defer the time left and hear from the government. Okay.
I think what I would say is very concretely, I would point to the example of Judge Miller in the transit ban case, who did not agree on the statutory holding that this court reached, but did agree that the rule was nonetheless illegal because of the fact that it wasn't supported by the administrative record. We think either before this court or another court, should the rule be reviewed, there may be jurists who might share that inclination, and that is one example of why we think one of the cases that present those claims as well would be the best vehicle to resolve the
legality. Is that the only sort of tactical consideration?
I think that's kind of maybe the most concrete one, Your Honor.
Concrete is yet to be cured, though, so I might still pepper you with some questions when you come back.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government now. George?
May it please the court, Matthew George for the Attorney General. I'd like to start out, I know the court invited amicus to participate in both the supplemental briefing and the argument today, but the government does have a concern when now amicus is the only participant in argument today. It raises some of the concerns about case or controversy and people without a stake in this litigation. Indeed, there's an attorney here representing petitioners who have a direct stake in this litigation who did raise this, and now that attorney apparently is not going to make any argument before the court, either about this rule or about the merits of the case. And that's, the government has a concern with that. The court may do with it what it will.
Well, any way you cut it, the rule is here.
But at the same time, now essentially all the argument the court has heard is from the same third party that's arguing in these other cases.
Well, the petitioner filed a supplemental brief as well, and the petitioner addressed the same arguments in his own way. Mm-hmm.
That's true, but
I mean, it's
the,
here,
the
so.
Court just heard 20 or 30 minutes of argument from not the petitioner.
What's wrong with inviting amici? We do that, don't we do that all the time?
It's more where petitioner is presenting nothing in this case. That's more the government.
But he has presented something.
But not today at argument.
Well, that's.
I maybe that's a small point. That's just a point the government would like to make.
Okay. Although you started out with the small point, perhaps not your biggest point. So why but, should it why should it be treated as a bigger point than you suggest?
Well, to some extent, yes. I mean, some of the concerns that the court has had in the past with some of these rules or these regulations are standing and case or controversy. And sort of these organizations that are bringing these challenges rather than people with direct stakes in the litigation. So here we have someone with a direct stake in this litigation who's not making any direct argument to the court. Yes, he filed a supplemental brief.
He's not making any oral.
Right. And I recognize that distinction.
Yeah, maybe, I mean, that is something that's new that just happened. If there's something right. that... Maybe you could present in a 28-J letter if they've got a
right.
conclusion argument.
Look, I don't think we're going to win on it, Your Honor.
I'm interested. Right. I've never thought of that. So
right.
if you've got something more, I think we should hear it. But okay. let's, I think, focus on the merits. Right.
Well, alternatively, we can invite Mr. Ao to make a comment.
That was
tongue-in-cheek, no. Judge.
It's just strange as someone who's done many arguments and with amicus many times, not particularly this one, but when the court directs them to divide time and there's no division, it's 0 and 15 or something.
I was surprised by that.
That's unusual.
Yeah.
It's unusual.
There's something to it. Just let us right. know.
Thank you, Your Honor. Going beyond that, the government does, I think, agree with amicus here in that this is probably not the best case to address this rule, given the alternative merits decision that the immigration judge and board made in this case.
Do you agree, though, that the other cases that Vika's counsel described would be better cases?
They're better in some senses. This one is better in the way that there is someone with a direct stake in the litigation who actually has raised the argument, and so some of those concerns about organizational standing and case or controversy and all that aren't present in this case, and kind of some of the reasons that amicus mentioned earlier about the breadth of the ruling. I think the government would probably prefer a decision from this court, maybe not in this case, but rather than vacating the rule in toto, which might happen with some of these district court cases, and then sort of litigating from that, this decision would cover essentially all of the Ninth Circuit, assuming I don't know if the court would publish it or not, and that might affect what reach that might have with the rule as well. I assume it would immediately go en banc, no matter if the court were to, probably whatever the court were to do. So
I have to say something will go on.
Do you know? Are there any other three judge panels, either here in the Ninth Circuit that have this case? I mean, I've seen this rule come up.
Right. This other cases,
mm-hmm. We've said we're not going to reach the issue because we're denying the petition. Yeah. Isn't there?
Right.
Aren't there other cases that have this?
I'm not familiar with them, Your Honor. There may very well be. And probably the ideal case for addressing this rule would be one where the agency didn't make alternative merits findings. I don't know if that would ever occur, and that's, I think, something really important for the court to look at when considering this rule. A lot of the litigation, the East Bay and the MA and the district court, look at this rule in the abstract, on an administrative record and all that kind of stuff. Here we have this rule applied to an actual litigant in the course of proceedings, and the court can see how this rule is actually applied. I know some of the discussion was between application and eligibility, and maybe even confusing those terms. The rule does say it applies to eligibility; it doesn't apply to applying for asylum. And this case illustrates that fact. Here, petitioners were able to apply for asylum. They had a full hearing on the merits of their claims, and then when it was time to make a decision on those claims, that's when the agency applied the rule and said, well, you're not eligible for asylum because of this rule, but I'm also going to make an alternative merits finding on asylum. And that's the only issue really before the court on merits is asylum.
Wait, so now I don't understand why the government then doesn't think that this is the best vehicle. Because there's none of the standing problems with organizational standing, which I've said my piece on, and we've got the facts of that.
Right. It's more in consulting with my superiors of sort of strategizing and trying to figure out what would really, how do we want things to proceed and all of that. I mean,
okay. So you would prefer to see, as Amicus does, that one of the district court case work its way through the system.
I can't say for sure that's what the government wants. That's going to happen probably no matter what. So,
well, I mean, it would also seem that if I accept Amicus Counsel's concerns about this case, you would want us to make a decision on this case because it's on rockier ground if it goes further up on review.
I mean, rockier ground in terms of the merits, or rockier ground in...
I mean, maybe either, but I imagine, so this case, I think from the way in which you're describing it, perhaps as Amicus Counsel is describing it, if the administrative record is really at issue, then this case could just simply be reversed on those grounds alone, as opposed to even addressing the rule.
We're talking about the merits of this case.
Yeah.
If that were the case, perhaps here that's not an issue. The record does not compel the conclusion that the petitioners are eligible for asylum.
Do you want to talk about the legal issues here? Why do you think the Attorney General has the discretion in light of 1158's restriction about adopting rules that must be consistent with INA?
Well, there are two things to distinguish between in terms of the statute and this rule. 1158A1 talks about application for asylum versus eligibility is what the rule talks about, and then it's B2C talks about restrictions on eligibility for asylum.
And when you say eligibility, are we talking about the knocking on the door, sort of metaphorically speaking, as opposed to... Actually, I don't want to spend too much time describing the metaphor, so I'll take that one back. But the eligibility to apply.
Well, yeah, I want to be very precise with words here about ability to apply versus eligibility to receive.
Right.
And so this case illustrates the fact that there was no restriction on ability to apply for asylum. Petitioners applied for asylum. There was no ban on that. There was no application of a rule or a regulation until it was time for a merits decision. That's when the immigration
judge... And that's the unique posture of this case.
That's how it would probably work in every case. There would be no ban on submitting an application because these applications are for asylum, for withholding, for protection under the regulations implementing the Convention Against Torture. So it's a unitary application, and then the immigration judge is going to... Is there a question?
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's a unitary application, and then the immigration judge is going to have a merits hearing on all of the claims and review all of them, as happened here. And then only when it's time for a decision on the merits of those claims is that ban going to be applied, or that bar. And that's because now someone's not eligible.
So a version of this argument was advanced in East Bay 1, the entry case, which the panel said, this really doesn't make any sense because... On the one hander says, oh, yeah, you can apply. Mm-hmm. The other handover says, no, you're not eligible.
Right. Does that make
any sense to you?
Well, I think this case illustrates why...
Or to the government, I should say. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Well, this case is a good illustration of why that's not the absurdity the court kind of mentioned before. And I think that's some of the drawbacks of litigating some of these things in that sort of abstract theoretical way is you don't see how the agency actually applies these rules. I mean, compare it to, say, the one-year bar on asylum when someone doesn't apply within 1 year of arriving. It's done the exact same way. They have a full merits hearing on their application, and then it's at the end that they say, well, you didn't apply within a year, so I have to deny you asylum. It's the same thing here. I have to deny you asylum because... I have to apply this regulation, and here we have.
So you're saying everyone that's subject to CPL will get a full blown asylum hearing, and they present all the facts and everything.
I can't say for certain. I don't want to make that promise. That should be how it works, assuming they're also applying for, say, withholding and cat protection. The merits are going to be the same for those claims, and so they're going to have a whole hearing on it, and then the agency can then assess of like. Well,
Right.
Maybe you merit asylum. Maybe we're not going to apply the bar because your claim is so strong or something. Like, I don't know how that would work necessarily. I mean, here, obviously, the merits of the claim don't meet the standard, and so they made...
Did East Bay 1 and 2, I mean, they made their way through review to the Ninth Circuit through the district
yes.
court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so this case is arriving to the Ninth Circuit through the BIA.
Yes, sir.
And that's also one of the reasons why, as I'm understanding your argument now, that's one of the reasons why this case isn't postured appropriately to review the CLP directly because of the administrative records, the existence of an administrative record and determinations by both the IJ and the BIA.
In terms of, say, APA, whether this rule is promulgated correctly and all that kind of stuff, yeah, those issues wouldn't be able to be presented in this case if that's something the court is concerned with. That would have to come through.
Let me ask you this. There's a lot of issues here, and I haven't really sorted them all out yet. But suppose we were to conclude that the rule is invalid, okay? Does that preclude the district court litigation that's ongoing?
I suppose.
All those other issues about
right.
about APA review and all that, whether the rule should be vacated, wouldn't that still be alive? And they would just have the district court would just have the benefit of a decision from us.
I think my armchair guess would be the district court litigation was still. Continue, especially given that some of the issues with the record, the administrative record, or how it was promulgated, aren't present, and so maybe that is still some piece of it that isn't waived or abandoned or something like that in terms of how it was presented to the court, and so all of those would be preserved. I can't say for sure. The only thing I can say for sure is it probably will continue no matter what in some form. It would be my guess, regardless of what the court did here, and maybe it would inform the district judge of what to do.
It seems like that any ruling here in favor of the petitioner would have to be very narrow. That is, it's because we're in a very confined kind of, we have an administrative record. I mean, there's only certain things we can look at and do.
Right, and also how the court framed the question in terms of the supplemental briefing that sort of limits the universe, I suppose, of what was argued and what was presented. I think it's all consistent with what petitioner presented, I believe, both to the board and to the court in his opening brief or there.
Right. He argued that it was invalid.
Right.
It's just a statutory argument.
Right. Yeah. Petitioner didn't bring up some of the other how it was promulgated.
Do you think the arbitrary and capricious is before us? It's a little ambiguous. I mean,
no.
The initial opening brief, I think, mentions arbitrary and capricious, but.
I'll say I didn't get that read, Your Honor. Maybe that was just this how I read it, but. I didn't pick up on that, but obviously I deferred to the court.
The words are in there. Just, whether or not it's a full-blown argument
right.
is questionable, but okay. Well, can I ask a question on the actual, on the regulation?
Yes.
So it's a rebuttable presumption,
yes.
And is it only the three methods in under subpart three that are the ways to rebut the presumption? Is there any other way?
Well, other than it not applying to the unaccompanied children, aliens with authorization to travel or seek parole, aliens who were denied, there's this sort of that class of people who it just doesn't apply to. And then, yes, I guess there is the acute medical emergency,
right.
the imminent and extreme threat to life or safety,
right.
and the victim of a severe form of trafficking. As far as I'm aware, those would be the ways to rebut it.
Okay, because I was just wondering if, you know, after hearing this full-blown asylum hearing, could mm-hmm. the IJ just say, you know, you've rebutted it through another way, even though it's not one of those statutorily or regulatorily listed ways. But you don't think that's the case?
On the face of it, no, I suppose. You know,
because they just say, you know, a rebuttable presumption, the exact phrase, a rebuttable presumption of ineligibility for asylum applies to an alien, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it opens up the possibility that there's other ways to rebut it. Right.
Certainly silent on whether that's an exclusive list.
Correct. That's a good way to say it. So, but you don't have a view if it's...
No, I think this is the first time I've ever seen it actually applied. and
Okay. But there are other cases where it's been right. There are.
I know. This very panel had another case with it and decided not to decide this issue and decided the merits of the petition. So that's what we would urge here. But
and then can you give me an argument on why you think East Bay 1 and 2 are not controlling here and must lead to the outcome that this regulation's unlawful?
Well, I think as the court has already gotten into a little bit, those are different regulations that were passed. This is not the exact same regulation. It does have this rebuttable presumption. It is not a categorical ban. That's probably the biggest thing, at least with the very first transit ban or port of entry.
I mean, isn't it a de facto categorical ban? With the numbers that we were discussing earlier, it effectively amounts to a ban that's categorical.
I'm not sure that's how a court would say it's categorical if the text doesn't say categorical. I mean, maybe the numbers are small. I mean,
form over function or function over form.
Is that a canon of statutory interpretation of?
Well, that's just me spouting at the moment.
It's not one I'm familiar with. I mean, there's a rebuttable presumption, and aliens can try to rebut the presumption. And maybe there are other factors that may be meritorious that they could present to an immigration judge that may carry the day. I don't know. Obviously, it's silent on whether that's an exclusive list, and so.
I think we're going to get into a discussion about terminology, and we were touching on it a bit before. But this non-exclusive list really is a function of the merits-based decision on whether to deny or grant asylum, not on whether one can, what one is eligible for asylum. And I think I need to drill this in, and I won't need your help in drilling this in with my understanding a bit more. I mean, I've understood this to be a two-step sort of analysis, a process. One is, are you allowed to apply? And I get you're going to say that anybody can apply, but there is a question of sort of eligibility first. And if you're eligible based on the CLP rule, then you still have all of the other factors and considerations an IJ can assess in determining whether asylum should be granted.
Well, that's the case for anyone, regardless of this rule, of whether you merit asylum. So let's take that
and
out.
And we're not talking about merit at all. But I just want to make sure that if I'm looking at these two spheres, we're setting one aside, which is the merits-based asylum decision determination.
Right.
And we're only dealing with, and CLP only deals with, are you eligible to apply? And I want to make sure, are we using the same language here?
Well, I would say it's not eligible to apply. You can apply. There's no ban on application. It's then whether you're eligible to receive asylum or be granted asylum.
Okay. I appreciate it. I mean, the nuance is important. The eligibility to receive is, understood. And that's where CLP comes into play.
Right.
And that's also where the government is, the Attorney General is restricted in what conditions or restrictions can be placed on the eligibility to receive.
Yes.
That doesn't exist in the other sphere that we're not going to talk about, which is the determination.
On the merits.
On the merits.
Right. Well, I mean, Congress did anticipate the Attorney General making restrictions on eligibility. I mean, that's B2C.
As
long as it's consistent.
Right.
With the overall statute.
And as long as this is consistent is also understood and means a restriction on authority, on the Attorney General's authority. It's not a grant of expansive authority, but a limit on what the Attorney General can do.
I suppose that's one way of looking at it, yes.
I think it's an accurate way of looking at it. But because in contrast, in the second sphere, the merits-based decision, that same limitation isn't present as it is in 1158, I think, B2C.
I'm having trouble determining what you mean by merits.
The second sphere that we're not talking about. I mean, the discretion for the Attorney General to determine whether to grant or deny asylum.
On the merits.
On the merits.
On the merits.
That's what I mean when I say merits-based decision.
Right. That would be after a determination of whether
understood.
This rule applies.
And what I'm trying to get, my point is that the statute is clear that there is a restriction on the Attorney General's discretion when adopting rules that limit or condition eligibility to receive asylum.
Yes.
That does not exist on the other side of the equation, which is the merits-based decision.
Yes. I think if I'm understanding, Your Honor, what you're saying is So the step one is whether we even get to that second step, correct. I guess.
This case is all about step one.
Right. Okay. Right.
But I'm using step two as just simply an opportunity to contrast what level of discretion or authority the Attorney General has. They're two different spheres. It seems to me from the statute, Attorney General does have greater latitude in step two than it does in step one. Do you agree or not?
In terms of, that's also statutorily restricted because an alien would have to meet the statutory definitions and elements of asylum. So that's my hesitancy to say yes. I think in terms of facts and things and maybe we're talking about the ultimate grant in terms of discretion, then I would agree with you, yes. Then the immigration judge could consider whatever he or she wanted in terms of making that decision.
Well, is the Attorney General's authority the same in either sphere to adopt rules that determine eligibility to receive and eligibility to grant or deny asylum?
No.
That's your position.
Right, and that's because that's what the statute says. I think we're saying the same thing. I'm not positive.
Well, I think you want me to agree with you.
But I'm, that's the case, isn't it?
I just see that the scope of authority for the Attorney General as granted by statute is different between the two, but you think that they're the same.
No.
No,
no,
what?
In terms of there is that in terms of putting, I guess, explicit limits on eligibility, they must be consistent with the rest of.
Is that same language consistent with, mm-hmm. also in determining eligibility? Excuse me, the grant or denial of asylum considerations.
I think based on that question, no. I think we're on the same in terms of the question I'm answering. You're asking and I'm answering.
I'm going to stand down. I don't want to consume all the time.
So you let me just shift this just a little bit in a different direction for a moment. And maybe I should have asked these questions of petitioner's counsel. Shifting to the eligibility determination, apart from the rule we've been discussing, mm-hmm. on the merits.
Yeah.
So if I recall, we didn't hear argument in this case when we were in,
no, Your Honor.
In Seattle. So we didn't get a chance to hear from the parties about the agency's decision on the merits because they made an alternative decision, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and the agency focused on two primary issues, if I remember correctly. I may be wrong. One was, what happened here didn't rise to the level of persecution.
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The other had to do with there a nexus?
Correct.
And that had to do with whether or not all taxi cab drivers were persecuted or only some of them were persecuted.
Well, the agency found that money was the motivation.
So that money,
not any protected
group. Right. So that money was what was in play.
Yes.
Only, and not taxicab drivers.
No membership in a group.
Right. And that underlying that was a notion that the board took was that they were going to assume, for purposes of the decision, that taxicab drivers or whatever was a protected social group.
It was a cognizable.
They didn't decide that issue.
No.
Right. Okay.
I'll just say that would probably fail. I mean, going back to a matter of Acosta, never been a group.
Yeah. But they didn't decide
it.
But they would have to decide it if we sent it back.
If the court determined that the record compelled a conclusion that membership in a group motivated Placido to extort the money, yes.
Yeah. So why, let me ask you this. There's evidence, why isn't this a mixed motive case?
No.
Why not?
Because the agency determined that money was the sole motivation here.
Wasn't there evidence that, you know, they were after all taxi cab drivers?
They were after money, and that's what taxi cab drivers had, or uh-huh. perceived to have, was money.
Uh-huh.
So in that sense, yes. And in the same way, are bank robbers persecuting banks? Just simply because they only rob banks?
Mm-hmm.
That's where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
It's
so there was, in your view, there was no evidence that that they were also after these guys, after him because of his status as a taxi cab driver making good money?
No, there's no evidence in the record that Placido gave had any care that it was a taxi business versus some other business that was producing money. Mm-hmm. He wanted money.
Bottom line, just give me your money.
Yes.
Whether it's 1,000, 8,000, or
100,000. Whatever. Whatever it was. He gave him, you know, he left him alone for years, and then as soon as he gave him the 1,000, now all of a sudden it's 100,000. Now I'm not, basically, I've got a fish on the hook now. Let me go for broke. Let me really go after this guy, because now he's responded. It's essentially like a telemarketer or some sort of spam email. Once you respond, mm-hmm. that never stops.
I recall, the record in the immigration judge did find the petitioner to be speaking credibly, testifying credibly about what occurred. There is a portion of the transcript in which the petitioner explains that they were going after all taxi drivers, not just some, and not just based on whether they were rich or poor. The rich or poor issue might have come into play with how much Mar 18 and the other individual, Placido, was asking for, but they were going after every taxi driver, mm-hmm. and there was evidence in which they did not go after restaurant owners. So it was very specifically and precisely focused on taxi drivers as a whole.
Yeah, taxi drivers who had the money or perceived to have the money. In the same way, people who go after, who rob banks, why are they persecuting banks? Or is that, they want the money, so that's where they go.
I mean, so you like the record to be framed and considered as a focus on money, not as status as taxi drivers. And would you agree, though, that if the focus or this court considers that this record establishes that all taxi drivers were preyed upon, mm-hmm. and it's a status, a particular social group, that it would rise to the level of a particular social group, as opposed to just simply going after money?
I'm sorry,
let me rephrase. So if we were to conclude that, no, this case and the evidence really establishes that it's that Placido and Mar 18 were focusing on the status, the group.
They cared about taxi drivers.
Taxi drivers. And not just to focus on money. What's your defense or counter to that?
I would say what in the record compels that conclusion.
Okay. So it's a substantial evidence question for you. Okay.
Right. And it's not just, is there some evidence of it?
I understand it's not just some evidence, but as I understood the record, it appeared to me that either the IJ or the BIA did not address the all-encompassing, all-taxi driver testimony.
Well, they did by saying money was the motivation. That's how they say that there's no other alternative. That's what the agency found here, was money was the motivation. There's no need to address something else when money was the motivation. There's no other motivation.
Okay. Let me just ask one more question. So this discussion that we're having right now, let's say if we were actually deciding the case, we would never get to this discussion. We would only get to this discussion if we were to conclude that the rule doesn't apply.
In terms of a straight application, yes.
Is that right?
Our argument was obviously this is an alternative finding. You can bypass the CLP and just address the merits. But
let me ask you this. Is it proper just to bypass this? The CLP and just go straight to the merits.
That's what this panel did in a companion.
Well, I mean, you know, the mem dispo. We can do just about, you know, with anything within reason.
Right. I mean, it's an alternative merits finding. It's a decision on the merits. Why, you don't need to decide something. I mean, that's what the Supreme Court said in Bagamasbad. You don't need to decide things that aren't that don't bear on the merits necessarily. You can deny this just on the merits of the asylum and be done with it. I mean, in a way, you could almost argue that if you reach the CLP and deny the merits or something, like it might be just dicta or something, because it wasn't necessary to decide the case. I'm not saying that's the case, but you can make the argument.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I don't, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Can you describe the evidence in this record that supports the BIA's finding that under the CLP, the petitioners were not subject to imminent extreme danger? Because I think, I mean, because in the reverse, if there is no substantial evidence of that fact, then they would be eligible.
Correct.
Under CLP.
Correct. That would be sort of an alternative
pathway.
Right. That's where they made the claim that they were kidnapped or subject to a threat of kidnapping by the smuggler, and then
it's actual testimony.
Right.
No one is controverting that testimony.
Right.
So at this stage, it's only a determination about whether occurred, in fact, rose to the level of extreme danger.
Right. I'm not trying to imply that didn't happen or anything like that. I'm just trying to use vernacular. So they said that they had this threat of kidnapping from the smugglers, and then they said that they were able to simply just walk away. And that's what the board said. That's why it wasn't an imminent and extreme.
What was the timing there? Do you know?
I don't. It's really a few sentences, really, of testimony about that petitioners provided.
Did it all happen like a few days before they crossed the border, or a few months before they crossed the border?
I'm really not sure.
Imminent
Your
means
Honor.
Like, you know, it's just like about to happen.
Like I said, I mean, it's maybe two pages total where they talk about it. And if this is something that they really thought was compelling, they should have raised it to the board. I don't think they made any argument sort of on the merits, really, to say testimony was missing or something of like, we didn't really fully present the merits of our exception to or our rebutting of the CLP rule here. And so what we're left with is just this really skeletal notion of a threat was made, they were able to walk away, and then the agency concluded that's not imminent or extreme.
I appreciate your paraphrasing and summary, but I understood the record to be a little more different. I mean, the threat was made to pay more money. If you don't, then I'm going to call, I think, the cartel to come pick you up, or I think the terms were screw you up, which was basically to take them up. Then, if I understood the testimony correctly, the petitioner testified that they had to wave a bus down in the middle of a road somewhere to be able to escape the coyote.
Right. That doesn't sound very imminent if you're able to, somebody has to make a phone call and you're able to go wave a bus down. It doesn't.
Go ahead.
Can I ask one question? I know this might have been addressed, but if the panel wanted to grant the petition on the merits, how can you avoid the CLP issue? Because
I don't think you can. I think the court has to address it in that
instance. Okay. Or you can't assume CLP doesn't apply or that an exception applies and then grant.
Right.
I think the
only way to grant it would be to decide it on the merits. Decide the CLP issue, whether it applies here or whether it's valid or what some sort of resolve that issue and then also resolve the merits issue. So
you can't assume anything away in the CLP, I guess. Like, you can't assume that exception applied or something. Okay.
I have one last question for you, from my perspective, for me only, and that is one of the alternatives the council proposed was, well, maybe you should just stay this case pending the outcome of the district court proceedings in East Bay 1.
We would not like the court to do that at this stage, given that the court has resolved the companion case already with the same issues, the same sort of on the merits type of thing. Who knows how long that could take? That could take years, really, for that litigation to play out, and that's not something the government wants in this case, given that we have an alternative merits decision. Essentially, they got the remedy here of, like, as though it didn't apply. They have a decision on the merits. This case is only about asylum. And then we're arguing whether they should be banned from asylum or something, but they have a decision on the merits on asylum.
Okay.
Is the Attorney General contemplating any other rules similar to these?
Not that I'm aware of. I know the option was there to extend this rule with this administration, and it opted not to do that.
I thought there was something in place, wasn't there? Didn't they promulgate something that was similar, and then it got stayed by a court in D.C.?
Most likely they did promulgate something, and it was stayed, Your Honor. I don't have exactly on point what that might be. I apologize.
I thought there was, there's so much going on here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Why don't we put 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. A few points. I thought I might pick up just on that last question, Judge Paez, to clarify. So after this rule was issued in mid-2023, in June 2024, the Biden administration issued what it called the Securing the Border Rule, which was basically a reversion to a straight entry-based ban that would apply in what the administration called emergency circumstances, so only when there was a certain amount of border crossings. But it was in effect for a number of months from mid-2024 onward, and then it was vacated by the D.C. District Court in early 2025. So that was sort of the successor to this rule. January 20th, 2025, when President Trump came back into office, issued an even more sweeping proclamation that barred asylum across the board at the southern border. That is a subject of litigation that's now at the D.C. Circuit. So that's sort of the state of play of successive kind of asylum ban type actions.
And was that was through an executive order?
Yeah, it was a presidential proclamation, right, without an accompanying regulation. In terms of maybe kind of working backwards, in terms of Judge Bumate, your question about a way to not reach the legality of the rule.
If they wanted to grant the petition, yeah.
Yeah, so we do think, again, that the court could reverse this to asylum and then remand, assuming the rule is lawful, remand for the agency to consider application of the family unity exception in the first instance. What the government said in their brief is the court shouldn't do that because the agency held that the petitioners were ineligible for withholding and waived that argument. But in their BIA brief, the petitioners argued that they established past persecution and that they established nexus. If they're right about both of those things, then those go to both asylum and withholding. So that's why we think if the court reverses as to asylum, it would make sense to reverse on withholding as well, and then remand for consideration of that exception, the family unity exception, that was never considered before by the agency. So that's kind of the route that we would propose.
And that's all without needing to address CLP.
Right, that's sort of assuming that the rule is lawful, you know, I guess sort of a type of avoidance approach,
right.
You could
assuming
say.
Assuming without deciding that CLP is lawful.
Right, and the agency should get the opportunity in the first instance to see if this exception, which could be available, applies. Council mentioned that this rule is not categorical and that distinguishes it from the prior rules. The problem with the prior rules is not that they didn't have exceptions. As I mentioned before, the prior transit-based rule did have an exception for trafficking victims. The problem with the prior rules is that they barred people from asylum for reasons that Congress in the asylum statute indicated were not valid reasons to bar people. This rule does that exact same thing. If someone is barred under this rule, it is because they did not come to a port of entry and did not first get a denial of protection from a transit country. So I think it operates in the same way in its operative terms and is foreclosed by those decisions. On the issue of eligibility to apply versus eligibility to receive, as Judge Paez noted, that issue was already decided in the East Bay One case about the prior entry ban. And I think as a practical matter, there's another reason that makes sense, which actually my friend mentioned, which is that the one-year application bar, which is sort of framed as a bar to applying rather than a bar to eligibility, is applied in the exact same way, the government said, and that's right. Even those quote-unquote application bars don't actually stop someone from submitting their application to the immigration court. The application is submitted, and just like in this rule, it then, you know, it goes to their kind of merits hearing with an immigration judge, and it's not applied until that point. So the way they function really is the same. That's even reflected in the asylum regulation, not just sort of a matter of practice in the immigration courts, but it's reflected in the regulation at 8 CFR 1208.13C, which says, for applications filed on or after April 1997, an applicant shall not qualify for asylum if either Section 1158A2, which is the application bars, or B2, which is the eligibility bars, applies. So the structure for deciding those bars, even under the regulation, is the same. I see my time is up.
Can I ask one question? Then, so I take it from your opening argument that there's an arbitrary and capricious claim in the East Bay 3 litigation. But I was just looking at the brief here, the opening brief. It does mention that this rule is arbitrary and capricious. So what's the difference?
Well, I think one issue is that, you know, this court's order for supplemental briefing and inviting amicus briefing specifically asked for briefing on the consistency with the statute. So we limited ourselves to a 15-page brief about consistency with
the statute.
But the
claim is here, though. Do you?
So I think there. So.
I mean, that doesn't limit the claims of this case if it's in an opening brief.
Right. So what I would say is, that's what we as amicus briefed. There are in the East Bay cases arbitrary and capricious claims that turn on the administrative record, as I mentioned before, kind of the record about the transit countries, similar to in the prior transit ban case. There's also arbitrary and capricious claims about the kind of the face of the reasoning of the rule. Perhaps this court could reach in that case. The district court kind of addressed those arguments in the prior decision before the previous appeal in the East Bay case, sort of about the reasoning of the rule. It's sort of assumption that people, specifically one of the arguments was that the agency is denying asylum for reasons that Congress didn't think were relevant to asylum, like availability of parole programs, things like that. I think if this court, you know, wanted to address those, it might make sense to ask for supplemental briefing on those specific arbitrary and capricious arguments. Unless you think that there's enough there in the prior briefing to get at it. But I would make that distinction between kind of the facial arbitrary and capricious claims that are about kind of the reasoning of the rule and the preamble on its face, which perhaps the court could get to, and arbitrary and capricious arguments based on the administrative record for the rule, which I don't think the court can really get
right.
to.
Because that's an APA claim.
It's an APA claim that, you know, this court's review of this petition is limited to the administrative record for this petition. This petition doesn't include the record for the rule.
Is it the first type of arbitrary and capricious claim you were talking about, the facial one, is that an APA claim too?
It's an APA claim. I mean, I think the court could perhaps, I don't know that there's anything that prevents the court from considering that kind of facial APA claim in a petition for review. If it's kind of about the face of the agency action, I think it would be perhaps unusual,
right.
But I don't know that there's something that would totally foreclose you from doing that. We do think that the district court cases kind of present the cleanest and most comprehensive cases for addressing the rule. Yes.
I did want you to try to come back with something
yes.
More concrete and specific about why you think this isn't the case that should address CLP, other than just simply it not being the best one. Anything else that you can tell me?
I think that's the reason for our concern, and the reason that we wanted to say that is we think there is other cases that present kind of additional bases, and that could be give the best chance of kind of getting an enduring decision.
So cases that proceeded through litigation in the district court as opposed through an appeal to the Ninth of a BIA decision are better cases to address CLP in your mind?
Yes, I think so. I mean, because they present these additional aspects of legality of the rule, including particularly claims based on
including arbitrary and capricious.
Including arbitrary and capricious, and particularly arbitrary and capricious claims that are based on the record. I do think that's a distinction that could become very important in further litigation on the legality of the rule.
And why is that? Why would it be more important or very important to address?
Well, it could be important because, as I mentioned before, not all judges would necessarily. I think it's this court's precedent forecloses the government's argument that this rule is distinguishable from the prior ones. We don't have Supreme Court precedent holding that yet, for example. So we're interested in having the kind of most comprehensive and strongest vehicle if this case, if the legality of the rule goes up for further review, which you think there's a good likelihood that it could.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both, and this case is submitted.
Thank you, guys.